be set up. Research I'm going to talk about is, in a sense, complementary to the kind of research that Agirre is doing through the National Agricultural Workers Survey, because I'm going to be talking about some of the evidence from our new pluralism study, which was a it was funded under a U.S. Department of Agriculture initiative called the Fund for Rural America. And we were looking in, we focused on case studies in six communities around the United States, which were rural communities that had high concentrations of immigrants, two in the eastern U.S., two in the western, the Pacific seaboard, and two in the Midwest. I wanted to say that our methods are much more qualitatively oriented ethno-survey methods. And so what's happened is where Susan's research provides a really marvelous structure for looking at what's happening at the macro level, we're able to fill in some of the flesh as to what are the social dynamics and economic dynamics in these small communities. What I'm going to talk today about is, in its largest sense, relates to policy in terms of looking beyond this veneer of homogeneity in looking simply at race as a determinant of access to healthcare, to look at diversity within each of these communities. And I'm only going to talk about one today, which is Arvin in the southern San Joaquin Valley. But it should be noted that all of our six communities have quite different compositions and ethnic mixes based on the history of migration. In Georgia, for example, we looked at a community that's only had migration for about 10 years. And in contrast, Arvin in Kern County in southern San Joaquin Valley is one of the more mature rural migrant destinations in the United States. It was interesting to us in as much as this classic study by Walter Goldschmidt, As You Sow, Social You Reap, which was done in 1946, gave us really pretty detailed baseline data as to what Arvin was like about half a century before we were looking at it, a little bit longer than half a century ago. So at that point, Arvin was a community of, with 12% foreign-born, and two-thirds of whom were Mexican immigrants. And we actually subsequently ended up interviewing some of the first immigrants to Arvin who are now quite elderly. And there's a long story about that, but one of the interesting things is that this is a community where for half a century, U.S. domestic migrants, Dust Bowl migrants, and foreign migrants mixed together. So, in contrast to the NAWS, we have a very small sample, but we have pretty in-depth information from each household. Arvin, how many unauthorized immigrants there are in rural America is an interesting issue, and it relates a lot as to what definition of rural one uses. Some of the classic definitions of rural are really probably not very appropriate for the 21st century, i.e., communities with 1,000 or less people, or 2,500 or less people, and so on. In California, I haven't tabulated, but the huge majority of communities that we consider to be rural are more in the 10,000 to 50,000 population range rather than the traditional ones. So based on that, I'm estimating that there's probably about 2.5 million unauthorized immigrants in these rural communities across the U.S., all of which have had huge growth in the proportion of foreign-born residents over the decade from 1990 to 2000 and ongoing. The first point I want to be made from Arvin is that there aren't really immigrant populations and native-born populations, because we really have these mixings where the one-fifth of town or so, 18%, are these native-born households. Then, due to the fact that Immigration Reform and Control Act passed in 1986 and gave pretty generous amnesty to farm workers, about 50% of the households in town are consist entirely of legal immigrants. Everyone in the household is legal. Some of them are naturalized citizens, but not many. Then there are these mixed status households, another fifth of the community, more or less, in which some of the people in the household are legal and others or are unauthorized. The story there is a complex one, but really one of the problems has been that in 1996, passage of provisions of IRA created some terrible barriers to the dependence of legal permanent residents getting authorized status. And then there's this unauthorized, these 13% of the households are ones in which everyone is unauthorized. And those include some households of lone males, the solo unaccompanied workers. So overall, we're looking at a very, very mature immigrant receiving community in the United States, but actually only one-third or so of the households in town has problems. But as I'll talk about later, those problems are pretty severe. Here, table one shows a different perspective on the diversity of immigration status in the community. And basically, if you look at the heads of households, you'll see that the overwhelming majority are foreign-born. Very few manage to naturalize, but many are legal permanent residents. And I look at table one as something like a snapshot of the past in the future in Arvin and communities like it, in as much as we look at the status of the heads of household, and that reflects past migration flows. And we look at the status, immigration status of minors in those communities, and it reflects the future of that community. And so as you see, very high proportions of the minors are actually citizens because they're U.S.-born children. However, then when we go down and looking at the minors, for example, this 13% who are unauthorized are a fairly small group, but their problems are very serious because they just happen to have the misfortune to have been born across the border, whereas their siblings had the good fortune in terms of immigration of being born in the United States. However, they're all living under the same roof. So one of the issues is that in looking at policy responses to improve access to health care, these broadly framed strategic approaches which don't take immigration status into account are very problematic, because if you look at initiatives just for children, they don't deal very well with the issue of these mixed status households and the diversity amongst children. And Similarly, we look at the interesting pattern in which actually a sort of naive view is that, well, it's the children who are unauthorized, but actually the parents are twice as likely to be unauthorized as the children. So children's health care access is actually much better than their parents. And so the question that I pose is, what are the future consequences of these disparities in family access to health care due to immigration status, both for the children growing up in immigrant-headed households and for this subgroup, which are these 13% of the minors who are unauthorized? These are, for example, the youth that would benefit from the DREAM Act if that legislation were passed. They're typically have bilingual, speak English well, and have grown up most of their lives in the U.S. Table 2 gives just a quick breakdown of the proportions in each age group of unauthorized immigrants, and this reflects the sort of intersection of changing migration flows and the fact that the last time that most people had access to legalization opportunities was in 1986. So as you see, this 19 to 34 year old group has the highest proportion of unauthorized immigrants. The older immigrants had, many of them had chances to benefit from the legalization program under IRCA, and the younger ones are more often U.S. born. Although, as you see, there's some proportion of children who are being brought with their families from Mexico. Since our study was completed in 2005, and it's an area where Susan's work and mine is complementary, NAWS is showing, for example, there's more family migration due to some of the fact that border crossing is now very expensive, and Mexican women are now have come to believe in many cases that if their husbands go as solo migrants, that's very likely to be the end of the marriage and the family, and that's often the case. If one wants to look at employment-based solutions, the perspective from Arvin complements the perspective from NAWS simply in pointing out that the unauthorized workers are concentrated in agriculture, and that they're concentrated in some of these particular demographic groups. So, as you see, these 13 to 18 year olds, for example, fairly small group, but almost inevitably they're unauthorized because they're very recent migrants who have come in the last year or two. Now, I used an old NAWS tabulation to say that only 17% of farm workers have health insurance from their employers. As Susan pointed out today, that's probably an overly optimistic estimate. With earnings having stagnated and probably beginning to decrease a bit with the current economic downturn, sliding scale fee structures are going to have even less promise. Should be noted that I don't go into it here, but there is one dominant migration network in Arvin, and that accounts for about a third of the immigrants in town. It's a network from the west central Mexico, from Guanajuato, Joconotle, Yuriria network. They have much better access to resources. I guess I wanted to finish up with pointing to the fact that we have to look at immigration status in relationship to other potential barriers to access to health care. And what you can see, I think, here in Table 4 is that the unauthorized households tend to be households which are likely to have other barriers to health care. Education, as you see, doesn't explain much. Everyone has low levels of education. But as you see, the authorized, the fully legal households and the mixed status ones actually have one of the good things about this institutionalized migration is a lot of the immigrants came when they were fairly young. So they've had some time to learn about the community. But as you see, the mean time in the U.S. for the adults in the unauthorized households is 4 years versus 10 for the mixed and 18 for the fully legal. The final overlay, I think, is the language profile of the households. And Table 5 gives you the proportion of the household preferred language, and we tabulated preferred language and second and third language for all of the members in the household. So these percentages are which language is preferred by what proportion of people in each household. As you see, even the fully legal households are very limited, and there are a lot of people in those households who don't speak much English. Mixed, worse language status, and unauthorized, still worse access to English. So I guess just to wrap it up, I think some very, very practical concerns are that, first of all, we need to pay attention to helping immigrants in these mixed status households, in the unauthorized households, learn how to navigate what resources there are available to them in the healthcare system. The challenges they face in deciding how do you deal with healthcare for the 11-year-old who's unauthorized and the 6-year-old who is are much more difficult to figure out. So I would argue for sort of family health access counseling. The second being to pay attention to these recently arrived teenage workers. We're currently doing review for DOL about how to respond to their needs. And I think finally, in the context of comprehensive immigration reform, I think public health professionals should probably advocate for provisions which give immediate access to publicly funded public health services rather than the possible policy outcome, which might be a delay of 5 years in access to those services. Because in the past immigration framework, there's been a tendency to delay access to services until people achieve full permanent status. So thanks.
We have time for one question, and then Brian Finch is going to make some comments on these presentations. Anybody have one question?